Coming up on the program, it is going to be a busy week in this economy, what you ought to be looking for. Also, and as always, if you are shopping online, people, caveat emptor, please. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, October the 28th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The macroeconomic phrase of the week this week is corporate earnings. We are going to hear from AT&T.
Google, Apple, First Data Corp, Stryker.
That's Jay Jacobs. He's the head of research and strategy at Global X. What is he keeping an eye on?
The tech sector as a whole derives a lot of revenue overseas. So if those earnings come in lighter than expected, you know, that might indicate more global weakness.
Constance Hunter, chief economist at KPMG, thinks we are going to just about see some of that weakness Jacobs is talking about.
The economy is definitely slowing.
Hunter is also the president of the National Association for Business Economics, which just reported that hiring by American companies has fallen to a 7-year low amid slower growth of sales and profits. Jay Jacobs, one more time.
We're still shaping up to see a third consecutive quarter of negative earnings growth, which is certainly not a great trend when you have a market at all-time highs.
Which we do today, but repeat after me, please, if you would, everyone. The stock market is not the economy. Two other things to have on your radars this week. Number one, the Federal Reserve meets on interest rates. I kind of think it's a coin toss whether they cut or not, but I should tell you I'm an outlier. Also, Friday is Jobs Day. We will get the October jobs report. Always a nice way to end the week, if you ask me. The straight-up corporate news on... Maybe I'm too excited about that. I don't know. The straight-up corporate news on this Monday is of the high-end variety. The luxury conglomerate LVMH, owner of, among others, Louis Vuitton and Dior, has decided it needs to accessorize. It's making a try for Tiffany, which is in a bit of a rough patch. That company's stock is down roughly a third since the summer of 2018, but LVMH somehow still sees a sparkle. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra looks at why Tiffany and why now.
Jewelry is one of the fastest growing parts of the luxury market. And LVMH, despite having a couple of watch brands, is not really known for its jewelry. Enter Tiffany, synonymous with Audrey Hepburn and, of course, high-end bling.
Tiffany is one of the few truly global jewelry brands, and that's why for LVMH, they are really attractive.
That's Denise Dalhoff, senior researcher at the Conference Board. But why buy Tiffany now when it's been struggling?
LVMH has likely been watching Tiffany's for years, and they're likely timing this to pay the lowest price they can and act as quickly as possible.
Stephen Davidoff Solomon at the UC Berkeley School of Law says when companies think about acquiring other companies, timing matters. Yeah, they want to get a good price, and often that means making an offer when their target is not at its peak.
I suspect what's going on here is that Tiffany's stock price has not performed well. The market thinks that they've not taken advantage of their brand as much as they could have.
Tiffany is still in a place where it's valuable to LVMH. Corey Kupfer is a mergers and acquisitions lawyer.
Tiffany is obviously an iconic brand, and some of those factors, you know, protests in Hong Kong and potentially the tariffs could be temporary situations.
LVMH has been on a shopping spree lately. In 2017, it bought Dior for $13 billion, about the same amount it's willing to pay for Tiffany. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
This item just in, Brexit, has been postponed. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the relevant details.
So January the 31st is the latest date for Britain's departure, the third deadline in a row. But don't bother to put it in your diary. There's a strong chance of a general election before then. If Boris Johnson wins big, Britain could be out of the EU by the end of December. And if he loses, there might be no Brexit at all. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
30 seconds of Stephen right there, about all it takes to sum up Brexit right now. Wall Street today, as I said, a record-setting day in equities. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We, that is, American consumers, spent $500 billion last year buying things online, $517 billion to be precise, up about 15% from the year before. And as we all know, where there is money, especially that kind of money, there are scams, especially scams buried in social media and on websites that you might otherwise not be suspicious of. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
Okay, maybe this sounds familiar. You're scrolling through Insta.
I started getting these ads for men's clothing and men's accessories.
Brian Smith, regular guy.
One of the ads was for a Goyard wallet. I don't know, they're like $1,000 or something at Barney's or Nordstrom. I clicked on it and it said they were around $75 or $80, some sort of flash sale.
So Brian buys one, goes to the website, puts in his info.
I got a confirmation email about 2 to 3 weeks passed. I didn't see anything in the mail. I gave it another week. I didn't see anything.
The wallet's not coming, Brian. It's not coming.
I went back to see if I could find them on Instagram and the account. I couldn't find the account. And then I emailed and I got no reply.
So obviously the wallet never came.
I don't know. You just feel sort of stupid. You know, like you feel a little embarrassed that you fell for it.
Well, if it is any consolation, Brian, you are in good company.
Online purchase scams are still huge. The volume's up significantly.
Catherine Hutt is a spokesperson for the Better Business Bureau. They received 10,450 reports of online purchase scams in 2018, and it is certain that a lot more went unreported. That was an increase, by the way, of 124% over the year before. Online purchase scams are both the most common scam and the most likely to get people.
It is a risk because it is so easy. It's so easy to click.
The most common items people are scammed by are clothing, jewelry, and pets. Puppies and kittens. Scammers can use the same ad targeting services that legit companies do. So you might see fake ads for stuff you're actually really into. In many cases, online purchase scammers also rely on a person's trust in a platform or app. Jonathan Eckert was scammed out of $20 for a necklace advertised on Instagram.
If it's on Instagram, I figured that it had some sort of protocols put in place to make sure that a business is legitimate. And it was the total opposite.
I think people are often surprised to find out that social media channels and online platforms don't screen the ads and they don't screen the sellers that are there.
In a statement to Marketplace, Instagram said that it has various systems in place to help us catch and remove suspicious activity before it gets to consumers, but they would not elaborate on what those were or how many ads it takes down or rejects. But there are a lot of other trusted platforms that can carry malicious ads, your favorite gaming app, for example. Legally, platforms don't have a ton of liability, says David Carroll, associate professor at the Parsons School of Design.
In most cases, platforms, as they're defined, get broad immunity from the Communications Decency Act, and it's the reason why platforms like Facebook and Google and YouTube especially allow people to post anything, really.
If there is one main piece of advice that Hutt has, it is take your time when buying something off a social media ad. Scammers depend on rash decisions. They're all about this flash sale or going out of business or look at this viral video or flashy photo. Again, Catherine Hutt.
Because they know if you take your time about it and research it, you'll discover that it's not such a good deal after all.
Jonathan Eckert, when his necklace never arrived, realized there were clues on the website that he'd missed.
It would say contact us, and then it was gadgetassistance@gmail.com. And I was like, what type of business would be on Instagram that has a contact us at a Gmail address?
That's if they have an email address at all.
If the only way to reach them is through a form that you fill out and then have to wait for a response, that's a big red flag.
Read the comments, says Catherine Hutt. Google the company or the product. You might find it on sale from a more reputable seller. You might find your seller on a list of scammers. Reddit has an ongoing list of online scams. The Better Business Bureau keeps a list, too. You can search. And if you have been scammed, credit card companies will often reimburse you, up to a point. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
If you want to know more about how to identify and avoid these kinds of scams, and you should, we can do that for you. Marketplace.org. There was an exhibition opening at the Louvre Museum in Paris last week, one of the biggest shows ever of Leonardo da Vinci's work to mark the 500th anniversary of his death. It took 10 years to track down all the pieces and negotiate the terms under which they could be borrowed. The Wall Street Journal had a story the other day about the cutthroat deal-making that museums have to go through to mount exhibitions like this one. Kelly Crowe had the byline in the Journal. Kelly, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So let's go through it step by step. So a number of years ago, the curator that you talked to at the Louvre decided he wanted to do a 500th anniversary thing for Da Vinci. What were his first steps? I mean, did he put together a wish list, basically?
Yeah, so typically they really do start out as historians. And he said, you know, you really do approach at least the concept of the show from a really academic sort of nerdy way. Like what new thing, right, can I explore about this artist? And then once that concept hangs, then what artworks do I need to really be able to illustrate it? And what do we have that's already in-house? And what would I need to go borrow? And it really is, they kind of approach it in a real methodical, strategic way in order to be able to put these shows together.
And the more you lend, the easier it is to get stuff, right? I mean, I guess calling in favors is a way to put it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it really is because, I mean, if you really think about it, these artworks are all precious and they're all one-offs, you know? I mean, that's the reason why we think they're valuable enough to be in the museum. So there are only about 20 Da Vinci paintings maximum in the world. So not every museum has one. And if you do not have one, either you buy one or you borrow one. There are very few options. Or you show a poster, which is not cool. So you've got to get the real deal.
Right, kind of lame. It is fundamentally a barter economy. I've got this thing, I'll give you this. You've got that, you give me that, right?
Yeah, it's fun because I sort of, years ago, I assumed that this was a major revenue stream for these big museums. I thought, oh gosh, these big encyclopedic museums that do have the best collections, they're probably making major hay with, being able to rent out the artworks. But it turned out to be a lot more of an academic realm in terms of bartering for things rather than renting them. I always get this like air traffic controller vibe about it, right? Like these, you know, museum directors around the world are really like conducting art around the planet. And it really is driven on the barter system by and large.
A couple of logistics questions as these paintings go around the world. Number one, insurance. And number two, who's responsible for these things as they are on loan?
Yeah, that's a good question. So that's really where the money comes in terms of a museum borrowing works. They won't necessarily need to rent the painting, but the borrower will cover any damage to the painting, what they call from nail to nail. So basically from the time that the painting is taken off the nail on the wall in one museum until it returns.
Wow.
So the borrower of a Caravaggio had to insure this Caravaggio for $120 million. Ooh. So obviously this is not your typical FedEx. This is much more tailored. Right. And that's where the big money, I think, tends to be sorted out within this realm.
The kicker on this story, and I love this so much, is that the Louvre has maybe the most famous Da Vinci, right? The Mona Lisa, but that's not going to be part of this exhibition.
Yeah, it's really fun. And I felt like, gosh, they did all this literal heavy lifting and they brought in the French president. And there was like major moments that, required to pull this show together. But the one painting that they knew not to even ask for is the one literally under their own roof, the Mona Lisa, because she's in her own bulletproof glass encased, little pod. Yeah. And about 30,000 people a day come through the museum just to see her. The exhibit spaces where they've set up all the other Da Vinci's really can only handle about 7,000 people a day. So it really wasn't even, it's a pity because I think it would have been really awesome to see them side by side. But, a curator can only do what he can do. He wasn't able to pull that one off.
Kelly Crowe covers art in the art market for the Wall Street Journal. Totally fascinating piece about how these exhibitions get put together. Kelly, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot.
Coming up.
You know what I always say is chicken pot pie a day keeps the doctor away.
We are talking pie, people. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 132 points today, 0.5%, 27,090. The NASDAQ up 82 points, 1%, 8,325. The S&P 500 up 16 points, 0.5%, 3,039. Uber said today it's launching Uber Money. That's a service geared at its more than 4 million drivers, which will let them have mobile bank accounts and digital wallets through which they can get paid. Shares in Uber up 1.5% today. Google's making a bid for the fitness tracking wearables company Fitbit, which would help Google compete directly with the Apple Watch. Fitbit shares up more than 30% today. Google's parent Alphabet up almost 2% higher. Marielle was talking about LVMH and Tiffany. Shares in the American Jeweler gained 31% today. LVMH down about 0.5%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The fires out here in California are getting most of the television time because the pictures and the reality are really bad. There's a statewide state of emergency. Tens of thousands of people are under evacuation orders. And there are more preventative blackouts on the way as power companies try to limit the risks. But wildfire season across the entire western part of this country is becoming more intense and more expensive every single year. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
The biggest issue when it comes to paying to fight a wildfire is where it begins. Susan Jane Brown is with the Western Environmental Law Center.
So on federal lands, the funding generally comes from Congress. And on non-federal lands, the funding will come from state agencies.
But many states can't keep up with the costs of fighting all these fires, especially the really bad ones. Scott Stevens is a professor of fire science at UC Berkeley.
If you look back, 15, 20 years ago, how much were we spending on wildfire? Maybe $200 million a year as a federal agency. Today we're spending over $2 billion.
California Governor Gavin Newsom has already secured a grant from FEMA to help fight these latest fires. For the wildfires that do start on federal land,
typically, the way that the federal government has funded that effort is through agency budget.
Susan Jane Brown again. Usually, that agency is the Department of Interior or the Forest Service in USDA.
But they've been consistently short of budget as long as I can remember.
Yeon-Soo Kim is a forestry professor at Northern Arizona University.
So they have to use the budget allocated for other forest management activities and use that money for wildfire suppression, which is called fire borrowing.
And when those agencies burn through that pot of money, they turn to FEMA as well. I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We are just about into peak pie season right now, which makes this next interview a happy coincidence because you can learn a whole lot about the U.S. and the global economy over a cup of coffee and a slice of pie at a pie shop in downtown Los Angeles any given morning, say 10:15 or so.
Oh, they changed the door. Hey, Sean, how are you?
How are you?
Good to see you.
Good.
You're just waiting here just for us?
Yeah, getting some work done.
There you go. It's a little empty. It early
you just missed the coffee morning rush.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Good.
Do you want me to hit the music?
Yes, yeah. Please.
1 second.
Sean Brennan owns the Pie Hole. We've had him on the program a couple of times over the past couple of years. They've got pies, sweet and savory. Coffee, too, of course. We're in the original shop in the Arts District, just east of downtown L.A. There are a couple more in and around the Los Angeles area, and for what it's worth, two in Tokyo. It's been a couple of years since I'd seen him, but Sean looks pretty good for a guy dealing with the stresses of running a small business.
You know what I always say is chicken pot pie a day keeps a doctor away. So.
Is that really? That's the rule to live by?
As of just this moment, yes.
Fair enough.
I started, as I usually do, with the basics. How's business?
Good. And
then we got to talking about how different his job is today, running an established business, than back when the pie hole had just opened.
It's much easier when you have a new business that's kind of a darling and
I mean, you guys were the thing for a while.
Exactly, right? And then you have to settle into having, good unit economics and it's really important to focus on being relevant and staying relevant and adapting to, the challenges of the economy and things like that.
Let's talk about the challenges then, right? Because you grew, you did some mm-hmm. expansion, you opened some places, you closed some mm-hmm. places. Let's talk through that a little bit because that's the crunch of the last 3 or 4 years of this business, right?
Yeah. If you open many restaurants, some will close, some will thrive. And you have to learn from those experiences and really provide that learning experience to inform what your plans are and how you go in the future.
So give me some examples of where you decided to open, but really you decided it didn't work out. What happened?
We franchise now,
yep.
Right? So
first of all, that's huge.
Yeah. So, that's part of the differentiation. We have to try to have as many relevant revenue centers other than just the four-wall retail that we have right here. And we had a franchise that was on the East Coast. It was the first one, kind of like a national expansion. That one didn't work out. There just wasn't enough volume. The marketplace wasn't robust enough in the way that we approached it. So,
yeah, the economy now is different than it was in 2011, mm-hmm. right? We've got app-based food delivery services. Right. We've got those kinds of intermediaries now between you and your customer. So, talk to me about life in an Uber Eats, Grubhubby kind of way when. Right. When what you guys are selling is a little bit of the experience of coming in here.
Exactly.
You know?
We don't view them as value-added or like a third-party delivery partner. They're direct competition. Hmm. The long-term value of our guests is really important to us. We want them to have a great experience kind of everywhere we can touch them.
Yep.
And when you outsource that and you give that away to Grubhub, it becomes their guest and not ours. And we're a hospitality company.
Yeah.
And that fundamentally just freaks us out, right? But then we get to pay them, you know, a right. commission
right.
for that service, and it's kills our margins.
But you can't not do it.
Can't not do it because that's where our guests are. I mean, we have to listen to where people are. We can't just hope people are going to come in. We have to meet, you know, consumers where they are.
Not to boil the entire hospitality and food industry economy down to one place here in Los Angeles, but as you look at the global economy, and I'm thinking now specifically about tariffs and mm-hmm. trade war and all of that stuff that is in the headlines, does that affect you? I mean, do you care about that?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, gladly and thankfully, the tariffs with Mexico weren't fully enacted, right? Because our supply chain is deeply entrenched in North America. It's not just Mexico, it's Canada. Produce and commodity pricing in North America would have really, really messed with us. I was very, very concerned about that. Wow. So we dodged a bullet there. And then there's kind of like a tertiary result for the Chinese tariffs and others is a lot of the suppliers, a lot of the vendors, a lot of the small business, medium-sized American businesses that we work with, they still get some raw materials from China. And they still outsource some printing to China. So any fluctuations in that ecosystem, especially from tariffs or pricing or whatever, they're going to hit me when I order some cups or some straws, biodegradable straws. And as we're talking to our vendors right now, I don't order anything from China, right? Yeah, and I don't sell anything to China right now. But they do, and they're totally freaked out.
There are going to be people who are listening to this who pay attention closely, who will remember the last couple of times we were here, mm-hmm. your former business partner, Lindsay, and her yep. husband.
Mm-hmm.
She is no longer here.
Nope. It's a kind of another philosophical approach to that. I think that in everybody's professional life cycle, I think we're seeing that they're just shorter now. And you know, Matt and Lindsay, mm-hmm. they felt the same kind of life cycle crunches that everybody else does too. And you know, if you remember, Lindsay is an accomplished actor and mm-hmm. screenwriter and right, and Matt's a craftsman and. When people ask me questions about that, I think the assumption is always like, well, things will always remain the same. And my philosophy has always been the only constant is going to be change. So,
Sean, thanks a lot. Really good to have you back.
Anytime. I'm happy to have you.
Talk to you soon.
You too.
Now I got to go buy some pies. Final note on the way out today, should you have a spare $250 lying around and a dissatisfaction with your current set of $179 Apple AirPods, Tim Cook and Company have just the thing for you. AirPods Pro. noise-canceling technology and those little silicone things on them to block out extraneous noise. Also, said the press release today, I'm not making this up either, they are sweat-resistant. All right, we're out of here. The Dow Industrial's up 132 today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ rose 82 points, 1%. The S&P 500 gained 16, about a half percent. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.